Can you hear me? Yeah, good. Do the names Adam West and Burt Ward mean anything to anyone? Ah, Lynn does. I'll give the rest of you a little clue. They played characters called Bruce... Oh, Rob, Mike knows as well. Okay, well, I'll give the rest of them a clue. The characters they played were Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson. No? Otherwise known as Mike?
Batman.
Yeah. And that was one of the earliest television shows I can ever remember seeing. And I think it was on either a Monday and a Tuesday, or Tuesday and a Wednesday, and it was about 25 minutes. And at the end of it, of course, Batman and Robin are dangling over a pool of crocodiles or waiting for a buzzsaw to cut them in half and so on. And some other things, you know, that's continued as a tradition in all sorts of television shows that, you know, Captain Picard's left being turned into a Borg in the season 3 finale of Star Trek. Job is in much the same sort of situation in some respects. So let's review the story of what has happened so far. So we've got a man who's described as a good man, careful not to do anything evil. He's concerned not only with outward actions, but with inner thoughts. He's thinking that his children might have cursed God in their hearts or done something wrong, and he's burning offerings for them. We have a conversation in heaven where Satan is present, and God holds up Job as an example before Satan. And then Satan presents this challenge. He says, well, Job's only doing this because you protect him, because you've given him all these things. And God responds to that challenge by allowing Satan to strike at Job. And he loses all his possessions, he loses his family, and then there's a round two. Satan presses the challenge and says, well, you've taken everything away, but he's still got his health. You know, he's okay. And the restriction on Job's person is limited. Job is severely physically afflicted, but he maintains his integrity despite his wife's reaction. And then at the end of chapter 2, his friends arrive, and remember, they sit on the ground with him for 7 days. And Job's there scratching his boils with a bit of broken pottery. And his response is absolutely amazing. He recognizes that all things come from God. He says, shall we not accept bad as well as good? Accept that God may take those things away. He worships God. He doesn't sin, he doesn't rail at, and he doesn't accuse God. But then, as you'd expect, finally, things get to him. He's overwhelmed. These friends do not help. He still doesn't accuse God. But his friends have this very fixed view of how things are supposed to work. They are unable to move beyond the idea that Job must have committed some sin. And presumably, since he's suffering terribly, it must have been some terrible sin. And they have these conversations, and they become increasingly irritated with each other in some ways. Job can find no comfort, but he steadfastly refuses to accept that he has done anything that is worthy of this suffering. But we do see in chapter 10 that Job still wants to know what offence he's committed. And by implication, wanting to know, he would also want to put it right as well. In chapter 16 and verse 19, he envisages an advocate speaking on his behalf in heaven. And in ways this may remind us, and should remind us, of Jesus speaking on our behalf in heaven. The situation is not an exact analogy, but I'm sure we're supposed to see that. And Job continues to struggle against his friend's worldview. But chapter 19 is interesting, verses 25 to 27. We see that he still has hope, despite what he fears presumably might be his inevitable death. He says, I know that my Redeemer lives. I myself will see him. And that should also point us to this, being able to say the same thing of Jesus. And those same three verses, I didn't realize because I'm not really into classical music, but Handel's Messiah, part of that starts with those three verses. And apparently that production rescued his career from the doldrums. And we should also note that in the Old Testament, a redeemer is someone who belongs to your family, someone who has more power and more resources. Boaz is Ruth's redeemer, and by extension also Naomi's. In the New Testament, although it's not an exact analogy, there are slight differences you could say. Jesus is our redeemer. But the story continues. And chapter 3 to 20 have been described as a dialogue of the deaf, basically because they keep on saying the same things over and over again. His friends say the same thing, and Job, in a way, himself also says the same things, although perhaps it's a little bit unfair to Job because he's saying the right thing and they aren't. Job, in chapter 21, he urges his friends to stop, look and listen. See that their worldview is not actually consistent with the facts. And that's something we should always do ourselves. You know, if we have a particular worldview, we should check it against the facts, what we can see and understand with our own eyes. And he wants to point out this flaw in his friend's argument. And he points to the world where wicked people sometimes do often prosper, and they live long lives. Nothing's changed, has it, really? I mean, if you think back, there are loads of examples. I'll just give you one. The financial crisis of 2008, if you remember that, was basically down to greedy people who overlent. They packaged up debt in virtually incomprehensible packages. They failed to do due diligence, largely got away scot-free whilst retaining large bonuses and pensions. But there is also, and this is where I think Job goes wrong a little bit, some incried criticism of how God runs the world. But at the same time, he recognises in verse 22 that God, or that might be chapter 22 actually, that God has a greater knowledge, that God cannot be taught by him. So he's got this tension between things not being as he thinks they should be, and yet he is that little wary of contending with God. And later God does gently rebuke him for that. And then chapters 22 to 25 is the third round of speeches. And it's almost as though Job's friends double down on things. They won't be moved. They don't respond to what Job has said and look and see that they might be saying the wrong things. Instead, they're hunting around for something that Job really must have done. And in chapter 22, Eliphaz appears with an angry tone almost, continues to maintain Job must be at fault. Now, he's still sure, interestingly, that God will deliver him if he submits, if he repents. And that part is actually true. But his accusations are hollow. They're inconsistent with what he's actually said complimentarily about Job's character earlier on in chapter 4. And then chapters 23 and 24, we see Job's biggest problem, really, is not actually just his circumstances. It's the fact that he has lost some kind of contact with Job, whatever that was. He's lost communion. He's searching around for him. He's searching in the different directions of the compass, and he cannot find him. When he refers there, incidentally, to God being at work, I think he's talking about the north. People then apparently seem to think of the north as being God's work desk or something like that. And in verse 12, Job's effectively saying that his commitment to God's ways were actually more than was required, as it were. And that, I think, is a challenge to us if we consider we live in a different dispensation, don't we? So we don't have a law that says you shall spend 6 hours at church on a Sunday, or you shall give this much, or your time or your resources. But it's a challenge to us as to what we actually do. There's a reference in one of the commentaries I have to a church notice board that says this, and there's probably more than one of them, I suspect. If God seems far away, guess who moves? And John Goldingay, in his commentary, says that although there's some truth in that, it makes him want to deface it. Because it certainly wasn't true in the case of Job. Job hadn't moved. If we have to characterize that in any particular way, God had stood back for a little bit. And it's not always true for Christians in general that that is the case. Sometimes it is, but it's not always true, and that's the important point. And then chapter... got ahead of myself a bit, but never mind. Zophar makes a rather pitiful speech in chapter 25, and then we come on to chapters 26 to 28. They're Job's final response to his friends. They're the last things he thinks he can say. After that, he's said all he can. And then there's a plea for justice in chapter 29. Job describes how good things were for him, and we read part of that, and how he hoped they would continue, and how he was conducting himself. And now, chapter 30, Job describes how bad things were for him. And I don't think that any of us can have anything much more than an inkling of how that must have felt for Job. And then Job describes how he's lived his life. He challenges God to say why this is happening. What's he done to deserve this summary? To deserve this treatment? And then in verse 35 of that same chapter, he challenges God to say what he's done wrong. And there is a bit of a parallel between God challenging Satan to say, look at my servant Job, and Job saying to God, what have I done wrong? And Job feels at this point that he's said all he can possibly say. He's moved through grief, in his grief through shock, silence, lament, longing, questioning, anger, and refusal to accept the way things are. And now he is waiting. All that's been said can be said. And his three friends see that Job is convinced of his own innocence, and they have nothing further to say either. The conversations have reached an impasse. I have another little quote for you. Mark Twain made the following comment on youth, and that has some relevance to Elihu, who's coming up in a minute. He said, "When I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant I could hardly stand to have the whole man around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much the old man had learned in 7 years. That said, age is no guarantee of wisdom, as we might take home from the fact that some older people have been jailed over these riots recently as well, and perhaps the behaviour of some world leaders as well. So, we have a new voice, and Elihu is younger. We presume that he's been present for most, if not all, of these conversations. But there was a protocol, so he had to defer to the older friends. And he's seeing that now it's coming to an end, and so he feels that he can speak. And much of what he says does certainly rehash what the others have said, using different words. He's still thinking some progress should have been made. It shouldn't have reached this particular point. But there are some new things that he says. He suggests that suffering is not always punishment. He suggests that God has not necessarily deserted Job. It says in chapter 33, God does this all again and again. He saves a person's life and gives him the joy of living. And it might be that we've heard of, I can't remember who it was, talking of God hounding him through the years, not giving up on him. And maybe that is part of God's dealings with some of us as well. And then chapter 33 says, God is greater than man, how strong God is, despises no one. There's nothing he doesn't understand. So he is trying to say to Job, this is who you're talking about. And then he proclaims the glories of creation as this storm breaks out around him. And Elihu, in a sense, has left Job nowhere else to go. And it's this dramatic interlude. But what it does show is that God answers in his own time. He answers when it's appropriate. Elihu has almost been his introduction here in talking about creation. And that doesn't always fit when we would like him to answer. But part of Job's troubles earlier were when a strong wind destroyed the house of his eldest son, who was hosting all of his siblings. Now God speaks in the middle of this storm. And if we casually read chapters 38 to 41, we could come to the conclusion that God is simply berating Job. But actually, if we look at what he says at the end, this is not really the case. And we should think of it more carefully, especially in the light of that. So perhaps God is adopting a more educative tone. There are several things to note, of course, about God's reply. Firstly, God does speak. And here the word Yahweh, meaning the covenant God, is used, in contrast to the use of El Shaddai, meaning God Almighty, which is used in chapters 3 through 37. And there's a detached and distant way of referring to God, which has gone. Just because God has appeared, nothing's actually at that point changed for Job, but God is there. Even in the midst of physical and mental anguish, Job had been distressed that he simply couldn't find God. And then we come to chapters 38 and 39, and the long review of God's creation that's there. And God wants Job to understand more about the world in which he lives. And so he's challenging his understanding here. He wants to understand God's role as a creator in the way that he's ordered things. But interestingly, note that God's purposes are not here explained. And there's a couple of interesting things throughout this passage. It says, rain falls where no one lives and grass flourishes where no one can see it effectively. Chapter 38, 26 to 27. And then he talks about the ostrich, this comical creature that's got a great turn of speed and so on, but lays its eggs rather stupidly on the ground and doesn't care for them. And God is not beating Job into submission or confession, but he is making Job aware of who he is talking to, of his relative ignorance of the world. And in a sense, he is taking Job out of himself. And sometimes if people are depressed, just looking at creation around can have an uplifting effect. I've heard some people remark that they are just not animal people. Well, my response is that doesn't appear to be true of God. And verses 26 to 27 of chapter 38 and verses 13 to 14 of chapter 39 also clearly imply something else, that the world was not organized solely for the benefit of humanity. In fact, in a really real sense, if we look at the creation story, we are here for the sake of the world. Genesis 2 defines our original and ongoing task to look after God's garden. Unsurprisingly, Job can find little to say in response to God here. He admits that some of what he said was foolish, but otherwise he does remain silent. But silence is not sufficient for God. He wants a response from Job. And if you look back in chapter 13, Job's talked about being quiet before God, but he also said he would speak if God called. And God is calling on him on this. He's pressing him, asking him whether he has proved him, he's trying to prove him to be unjust. And there are two implied criticisms that Job has made of God if we look back. Chapter 19, he's implying that God has failed to exercise his authority over the world because things are going wrong. And in chapter 22, that his decision-making is somehow random. The gist of God's response in verses 6 to 14 is that God is God, only he can run the world. And if you've seen that film, Bruce Almighty, that's what that is also saying. He wants to do everything good for people, but he hasn't got the wisdom to do it. If everybody gets the right numbers for the lottery, they get very little back. No human being has the necessary wisdom to do God's job. In the remainder of chapter 40, chapter 41, we see God simply describing two huge creatures, one land-based, one sea-based, and pointing out that human beings cannot control them. So God is saying, I have the power of creation and I have the power over creation. He's wise and powerful in ways beyond our understanding. And despite all our scientific advances in knowing what God has done and perhaps how he has done it, that is still absolutely true. Because there's much that we don't know, and certainly much that we cannot do. As the psalmist says, God's ways are and thoughts are higher than ours. And in chapter 42, Job acknowledges more fully his own ignorance. He repents before God, not of the sins which his three friends had insisted he committed, but of speaking wrongly about God himself, of overstepping the mark in accusing God of being unjust. It's important, though, to understand that Job has been still been given no explanations. But he does say in verse 5, "In the past I knew only what others had told me. Now I have seen you with my own eyes." There's been a new, fresh revelation in some way. That fourth voice, Elihu, is not mentioned, perhaps because he's younger. He hasn't said things that are quite so bad as the other three friends. But that dispute between the friends is finally settled. Job is vindicated in the main from that. And he prays for his friends as he was commanded to do. And then Job's fortunes are restored. Not just restored, actually, but they're doubled. He goes on to live even a double life, 140 years. And if you look back through Scripture, at one point God says, "I will not contend for more than 70. So he's got a double life after the one he's already had. And he sees his great-grandchildren. So what do we actually take away from this whole story? Well, so much of the conversation is around this idea that suffering happens as a result of sin. Now, of course, it can do, but what is said wrongly here is that all suffering is the result of sin. It's clearly the argument of Job's friends, the traditional view that they're unable to escape from. And to some extent, Job himself may have thought in those terms as well, until, of course, he found out this isn't really true and looked around and then recognised that it wasn't true. And both from the opening two chapters of the book, where we see God's view of Job, and from God's clear statement in chapter 42 and verse 7, Job's friends have not spoken what was right, and we must categorically reject a direct cause and effect relationship between the sin and suffering of individual people. That's not to say that some of the things they are suffering might be due to something they have done, but we cannot lay all the suffering of any individual on things that they have done in the past. Sometimes people just suffer. And in the New Testament as well, that is confirmed. Jesus rejects the same view when he talks about the man being blind in response to the disciples' question. And secondly, that realization has to guide our own personal response to suffering, our own and to others. We live in a fallen world, and suffering of some kind is almost inevitable, whether it's in any sense at all or not, deserved or undeserved. What the story of Job does is to reassure us that God sees and hears everything that happens, that in the end, he has the final say. It's true where Satan is involved in the spiritual world. Satan needed God's permission. But it's also true in the natural world. God sees and knows. And we cannot blame God for all of these things. If, as human beings, we build on floodplains and on fault lines, then what do we expect? And Job says in chapter 42, verse 5 again, "My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you." In that repentant attitude, he realizes in a new way who God is. He realizes his own limitations in understanding the world. It's interesting that he grants an equal inheritance to his daughters. And only his daughters, you'll note, are named there. It certainly wasn't the norm in those days. I don't like the word particularly, but I suppose you could call Job the first feminist. But in any respects, he was certainly ahead of his time. It certainly shows his love for all his children. And Job's friends have also learned to examine their thoughts more carefully in the light of experience. Their initial response, though, of just sitting with Job for 7 days and seven nights might be something that challenges us the next time we see somebody suffering. And then thirdly, we should, I think, appreciate afresh God's power, knowledge, and his ownership of the world. God speaks a good deal about creation. There's an undeniable element of completely justified pride in creation, just as there is, incidentally, in the original story in Genesis 1. So many times God looks and says, "It is good." And the main purpose of these speeches is to educate. And there's surely an implied challenge as to how we live our lives in a universe where God, as God proclaims in chapter 41, verse 11, "Everything under heaven belongs to me." And quite apart from that statement, there's a clear implication that we as human beings have only a limited view of what is going on. At best, we see the backside of a tapestry, which is untidy and rough and disorganized, whereas God sees the beautiful picture on the other side. And fourthly, we must trust God in difficult circumstances when no answers are available. That was the challenge that Job had, wasn't it? And he came through it superbly. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? He goes a bit too far when he complains about the way that Job runs the world. But throughout his experience, he's longing for God. He's looking for God. And he says at the end, "Surely I spoke of things I didn't understand, things too wonderful for me to know." And we should note, he never gets an answer to the question of why God allowed, or more in Job's mind, caused his suffering. So that response is all the more remarkable, for that. With those snippets of conversation, don't we, between God and Satan, but they too only explain things to a certain extent. We're surely meant to understand that we may find ourselves almost as much in the dark as Job did. And yet, we have that example of Jesus. And we know that God has intervened for us and on our behalf, that he is a Redeemer who speaks before God for us. But there's still that challenge to acknowledge that God's thoughts are higher than ours, and God's ways are higher than ours. Hebrews 11 challenges us to the same thing, to be sure of the things we hope for, certain of the things unseen. And at the end of that same chapter, it records how it was by their faith that the people mentioned received God's approval. The book of Job ends with the words, "And so he died old and full of years." But perhaps it could equally have said, "And so he died old and full of faith." And finally, before I close with a quote from somebody, perhaps the second part of Job's life being even better than the first is like seeing through a glass darkly to the life that we who have placed our faith in Christ have been promised after this earthly one comes to an end. I wasn't sure whether I wanted to include this quote here at the end, but when we were actually reading Job chapter 38, it talked about the doors of the sea, if you remember. There was a great tsunami on Boxing Day in 2004, following an earthquake. And there were a lot of people saying things about that in newspapers afterwards. And there were some atheists sort of proclaiming, "Where was God?" And there were some Christians with extreme theological views saying some very unpleasant things and very untrue things. And David Bentley Hart wrote a book which he called The Doors of the Sea. It's a little bit highbrow, but it's an interesting book. It's not a hugely long book. And he was looking through these things. So I'll include more or less what he says at the end, towards the end of the book. And this is about us not having answers. God will not unite all of history's many strands. Much will be judged false and damnable, but he will strike off the fetters in which creation languishes. Rather than showing us how our sufferings were necessary, he will wipe away all our tears from our eyes. There shall be no more death, nor sorrow, nor crying, nor any more pain. For the former things will have passed away. And he that sits upon the throne will say, Behold, I make all things new.